This on the Pacifica Radio app. This is Houston's community station. We are Quantum Leap Radio.
90.1 KPFT FM HD2 Houston.
Radio with Maya Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories, and hopefully some of the stories you've missed. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
You know, we just finished an election, but I have to tell you, there's another one coming up. I'll be briefer than I was last week, but on May 7th, we have a constitutional and local election. You can check all this stuff at either harrisvotes.com or you can go to thinkwingradio.com and it will be near the top of today's blog post. All right, starting with from communityimpact.com, Montgomery County returns $3.2 million in rental assistance to U.S. Treasury. If this sounds familiar, it's because it's similar to a story we talked about a couple, 3 months ago.
Something like that.
Montgomery County commissioners approved a de-obligation. Never heard that word before, and neither did Microsoft Word. Anyway, they approved a de-obligation of $3.2 million in emergency rental assistance funds to the U.S. Treasury at a March 8th commissioners session. The Treasury Department has set a March 31st deadline to recapture unused assistance funds. In 2020, the county received $18.1 million in emergency rental assistance funds through December. The county returned $7.1 million in November of 2021, Community Impact previously reported. Following that release, the county created a new assistance portal for residents to apply for aid. County Judge Mark Heough cited a lack of applicants in November, but anticipated more residents would seek the ERA funding in 2022 when other federal grants expired. Community Development Director Rebecca Ansley told Community Impact in a March 9th email that the county had spent almost $1 million in aid as of December. Texas Housers researcher Ben Martin, Texas Housers being the name of a group, said it was important that counties, including Montgomery County, keep unused rental funds in Texas by sending them to the Texas Rent Relief Program, which is run by the Department of Housing and Community Affairs. Although Texas Rent Relief's direct portal is closed as of January, spokesperson Christina Trelawney said the program has invited counties to send unused funds to them and has requested more funds from the Treasury Department. Martin said when money is recaptured by the Treasury, it is not guaranteed to return to Texas counties that may need more. Martin said, we saw throughout the holiday period in the last few weeks, another pandemic wave had a big impact on people. Montgomery County needs to have a plan for voluntarily reallocating this money to the Texas Rent Relief Fund. Ansley told Community Impact newspaper the county requested its first $7.1 million disbursement to go to Texas Rent Relief, but the March 8th disbursement was requested directly by the Treasury and the funds were required as soon as possible. Andrew, anything?
Yeah, I mean, we have heard stories in the past of counties, you know, holding back their rent relief and having to return to the Treasury. And I think in this instance, because it was specifically requested by the Treasury, a specific dollar amount, it was requested as soon as possible, their hands were kind of tied. I don't necessarily begrudge them for this. But it does suggest to me the fact that they only spent under a few tens of thousands of dollars under $1 million in December, as of December, actually. I mean, that does suggest to me, you know, they're returning, what was it, $8 million or something like that back to the treasury, like, and they've only spent under $1 million?
Let's see.
Or $7 million or something.
So
like that?
they received $18.1 million. They returned $7.1 million in November. So almost half of the money in November got returned.
Yeah.
Let's see. And then they spent $930,000 as of December. I rounded up to $1 million.
Yeah.
And then they returned
another $7.1 million.
Another $7.1 million.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just hard to imagine that there weren't more people in need. So,
yeah.
I mean, my suspicion has to be that it just wasn't well publicized.
That,
in Houston, it was really well publicized. In Harris County, it was really well publicized. You almost couldn't avoid tripping over it.
Yeah.
It's entirely possible Montgomery County, not so much. But I don't know.
Yeah, we're not sure. We can't make definitive claims here, but my theory is either it wasn't well publicized, or the eligibility requirements were unreasonably high, or they just didn't give as much money as they could have to everybody who needed it. You know, they overestimated, or whether intentionally or unintentionally,
under-disbursed, I think is
more likely. They under-disbursed, whether intentionally or unintentionally, and I think that it's, you know, it is kind of a shame, because there are a lot of people out there who could use this kind of relief.
Our next story from communityimpact.com, Tomball ISD considers staggering the start times for all campuses. Stephen Gutierrez, Tomball ISD's chief operating officer, proposed staggering school start times in four tiers during a workshop presentation to the TISD Board of Trustees March 7th. These adjusted start times are anticipated to enable students to arrive and leave school on time while accounting for the ongoing bus driver shortage TISD has been facing. A 30-member school start time committee did research, received parental feedback, and worked with the transportation department before settling on a draft four-tier bell schedule to present the board. Gutierrez said this tiered plan works with the amount of drivers the district is currently able to employ. The district has continually been short 25 drivers, he said, which has contributed to lengthy bus routes, crowded buses, long ride times for students, and late drop-offs and pickups for students. He said, when you think about cost savings and efficiency first and foremost, I would think students, but, you know, who am I? When you think about that stuff first and foremost, our students get a better experience with this plan, and we can do it with 25 drivers fewer. Kim McKinney, TISD's Grand Lakes Junior High School principal, said during the meeting the four different tiers also allow the district to avoid busing intermediate students with junior high and high schoolers, which has been an ongoing safety concern for families in the district. This has been a huge thing, she said. We've heard it for years. From a safety perspective, there's a huge gap in age there, and so this fixes that issue as well. During the workshop meeting, Trustee Michael Pratt asked if pushing start times later in the morning had been considered instead of an early start. Superintendent Martha Salazar-Zamora said the concern with starting later is, and I have this highlighted because I think it's worth noting, many older students work after school or are involved in school activities that often must be held at similar times as other competing districts. This means if students start their school day later, they also end it later, she said. TISD trustees did not take action on the tiered schedule on March 7th as the presentation was given during a workshop meeting. So I don't have the schedule included here because that's just a whole lot of times and tables and stuff. But the thing that struck me is that the earliest bus stop time, and I'm guessing this is not news to a lot of the people listening, but I haven't had a kid in school for a while, 6:45 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So now, some of the latest times, I think the latest time, Andrew, was what, like 8 something, 8:10?
Something like that, yeah.
Or I think getting to school, I think one of the class tiers started at like 10 after 8 in the morning.
Yeah.
So they had to be like at the bus stop by 7:30. I mean, to me, that has always struck me as child abuse. It's also parent abuse and teacher abuse, but yes, it's child abuse. I mean, when you work backwards, if you have to be at a bus stop by 6:40 frickin' 5 in the morning, that means you probably have to somehow get bundled into a car, let's say by 6:30. All the goodbyes, you got your books, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're going to be in the car by 6:30, if you want to do a panic morning, I guess you could get up at 6, depending on how many kids you've got and how agreeable they are to early mornings. Maybe 5:45, maybe even 5:30. 5:30 in the morning. You realize that's almost as early as bakers get up in the morning. In order to get to the bakery and make your bread or your bagels so that you can bring them into work. I mean, that's... And the thing about students having jobs after school, you know, I guess there's always the possibility that instead of exploiting teenage labor, they could always hire older workers and pay a little more.
Yeah.
Some of those people could use jobs. Mm-hmm. The only thing I can see here that makes any sense is... if they're going to be doing school sports with other schools, they need to be on the schedule with other schools.
Yes.
That is something that I can kind of see, but I also can't believe it's insoluble. It's kind of like when I went to school, if you had kids in the scouts, if they had a scouting day, they would just miss a class at the end of the day. And that would be that. So.
Yep.
I'm not advocating that, but I'm saying it's not insoluble, and it's sort of better than child abuse where you wake up with the bakers.
Yeah.
Andrew?
Well, I did not grow up in Tomball ISD, but I did grow up in Alvin
Just
ISD.
Just FYI, I was in Brooklyn. We're talking 50s and 60s.
Right. 50s and... Yeah. This story is... from, you know, Alvin ISD in like 2011, 2012. So, you know, about 10 years ago now, but not
you old man.
Not as far back as that. When I was in my freshman year of high school, that was the first time I ever actually had to take the bus because I went to Manville High School, and I live in Pearland. It was far enough away that my mom did not want to drive me every morning, and I don't blame her. So I had to walk to a bus stop. Well, it wasn't even a bus stop because we don't really have bus stops in my neighborhood. We walked to a mailbox that was maybe 3 or 4 streets down from mine. And
well, in Tomball, I'm betting that in many cases it's a driveway that passes over a bio ditch.
Yeah, probably something like that. You know, it was a few streets away. And I remember when I would get to that pickup stop, it would still be dark out. Like I would be playing, you know, Plague Inc. on my phone under the streetlights, you know. So I'm not necessarily – I don't find it as – I don't remember exactly when we had to get picked up, but I don't find it as odd as maybe Mike does to be waiting for the bus in the dark.
It's not waiting for the bus in the dark. In Brooklyn in the winter, the sunrise comes up like after 8 in the morning and it goes down by 4:30 in the afternoon. So dark is okay. I'm just talking about freaking early.
Yeah. And like my personal experiences are limited by the fact that I don't remember when exactly I had to, you know, get up and get out to the bus.
Didn't matter. It was, Andrew, get your butt out of bed.
But I remember that it was early enough that I usually had breakfast at school. I usually waited until I got to school to buy my breakfast. I definitely see where you're coming from, and I definitely think that 6:45, because as far as I can tell from the investigating we did beforehand, 6:45 is about when you could start dropping your kids off, or when they expected them to start showing up at the pickup location at the bus stop. Exactly. So you don't have to have them there by then. You just have to have them there between then and when the bus arrives. That was my
interpretation. Because if the bus arrives early, you're driving them old.
Yes, that's true. So, I can see where you're coming from that, you know, this is too early. 6:45 is too early.
And there are studies that repeatedly show that having kids, and we're not talking about the teachers or the parents here, but just having kids get up and get to school that early impairs performance, impairs mental acuity, is nuts. It's just an all around bad idea.
Yeah. And so I absolutely agree that, you know, it is not really reasonable, the justifications they're giving for having the school start this early, having the kids get up this early. You know, they could just push it back by an hour. And this isn't even to address the fact that they are working with a driver shortage. Like the tier system, yeah, if that helps, you know, get the buses working on time, great. Just don't do it so early.
Actually, you know, here's a thought. Maybe if the buses didn't have to be starting to pick up kids by, say, 7 in the morning, and your bus drivers weren't having to get up at 5:30 to get the buses there, maybe they would have more success hiring those additional 25 bus drivers.
That and probably a pay rise would make it.
Yeah, a little of both.
A little of both.
Okay. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m., live online at kpft.org, or you can podcast it or go to archive.kpft.org and listen to not only prior versions of Think Wing Radio, but also one of the 100 other titles that we have. So a good resource. Every story on this show is usually heavily excerpted, so I put links to the full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Just click on show posts and more and find the post for the show or show date you're looking for. You can also type keywords into the search bar. We're also on social media where we can take questions, comments, and suggestions. Check the show's Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig, or look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio, and Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE and spelled the same on Tumblr at DominateI.tumblr.com. Plus, if you want to hear more of my political opinions and are interested in video games, I do live streams on twitch.tv/DominateI Mondays and Fridays, currently at 8 p.m. U.S. Central.
So video political games.
Yeah.
Okay. Our next story from CommunityImpact.com, Harris County Flood Control District breaks ground on two spring area projects in the Cypress Creek watershed. The HCFCD officials hosted a groundbreaking ceremony March 10th for two projects in the spring area of Cypress Creek. According to a March 7th news release, the first project will include construction of a stormwater detention basin on a 6.8-acre area located just north of Cypresswood Drive between I-45 and the Hardy Toll Road. Upon completion, that basin will hold roughly 37 acre feet, or more than 12 million gallons of stormwater during heavy rain events. The second project is located about a quarter of a mile north of the first project and will have an additional capacity of 12.2 acre feet, or roughly 3.9 million gallons of stormwater. So your tax and bond dollars at work. Andrew?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Our next story from CommunityImpact.com. Light pollution and parking discussed as Bel Air continues debate over Fornis Development District. For the second council meeting in a row, the Bel Air City Council debated land use of the former Chevron campus within city limits, now known as the North Bel Air Special Development District. Among matters discussed, council member Catherine Lewis made a presentation citing the potential effects of light from some of the taller proposed buildings in the plan, emphasizing the need to protect surrounding neighborhoods from light pollution. The city's requirements call for opaque screening in certain areas to block light from entering adjacent residences. Also on the agenda, officials with the Evelyn's Park Conservancy Board announced an opening of the park's second phase in either late March or early April. Improvements will include a solar-powered shade structure for small gatherings, a large covered pavilion with movable seating, an interactive splash pad, and two interactive playgrounds. The council, and this is important, also approved a design contract with Ardora Group for the installation of a 500 kilowatt generator at the field park water treatment facility. allocating a little over $76,000. Once completed, the project will provide the city with full generator power at two of the three water production facilities, which will provide for additional protection against the impacts of a prolonged power shortage, according to the council agenda packet. So I thought that there were, I think, three interesting items here in this story. The light pollution aspect, the solar panels for a shade area in the development, and I think a big deal given our relatively recent experience, backup generators for the water supply.
Yeah.
Which I no longer take for granted if I ever did.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Andrew, anything additional?
This concept of having the you know, spending this $76,000 on a generator for the water treatment facility, I think it's something that a lot of local governments would have considered much less of a priority before we had our big ERCOT mishap.
And it's really small potatoes money. I mean, yeah. We're talking about the city of Bel Air, you know, start doing multiplication in terms of tax revenues.
Yeah, it's definitely a easily affordable cost for on a city scale, and it's going to provide, you know, even if it doesn't cover the entire city, it will cover, you know, it will maintain water access for a significant number of people, and that's worth it. So,
and it's also possible, although I don't know for certain, it's possible they have diverters that can direct water from one district to another. If they don't, they probably should.
Yeah, it's another thing to look into.
Our next story is from communityimpact.com. The Gastronome Russian Food Store in spring changes its name and sends support to Ukraine. I think this story is interesting on a couple of different levels. The Gastronome International Food, located at 1421 Spring Cypress Road in Spring, has changed its name from Gastronome Russian Food Store in light of the current Russia-Ukraine conflict. Owner Dmytro Ivanov is from Ukraine, but he originally included Russian in the name of his store, which sells treats from a variety of Eastern European countries to make it easier to identify for Russian-speaking communities, he said. After Russian troops launched attacks in Ukraine in late February, Ivanov said he worried about the safety of his mother, who lives in Kharkiv. The city has been bombed nonstop since the fighting began, Ivanov said. It took my mom 4 days to drive from Kharkiv to Warsaw, Poland. Very stressful 4 days in our lives. Ivanov said his mother plans to travel to Spring by March 13th. Meanwhile, Ivanov has been raising money and donations for the people of Ukraine, sending a truck with 8 pallets of donations to those in need March 7th, according to the business's Facebook page. So we have another example here where everybody assumes, or not everybody, but many people assume that anybody who is Russian joined in the Russian invasion of Ukraine, kind of like anybody who was of Japanese ancestry joined in the attack on Pearl Harbor. But weirdly, that when we declared war on Germany and Italy, we didn't necessarily, although I guess some did, take it out on Germans and Italians. I do think there was some of that. So apparently, you can't have enough distance either in geography or chronology to avoid association with something your distant ancestors or relatives, you know, like seventh cousins, may be responsible, because people are like that. Andrew?
Yeah. Yeah, it's something that has been really ramping up, obviously, since the Russian troops moved into Ukraine. The irony is that, you know, these the people and businesses being targeted in a lot of these sort of retaliatory attacks or boycotts or any kind of action like this are often Ukrainian. The people who run them are from Ukraine, not Russia, but they...
That it should matter.
It shouldn't matter. It shouldn't matter. But it is kind of ironic, and it's interesting to note that, you know, it's just because Russia has a sort of... The term Russian is more recognizable. And so... You know, you're seeing as well a lot of disorganized boycott efforts. People aren't doing the research that they need to do to understand what will actually have a useful impact in ways of showing support for Ukraine. And a lot of the time, you know, boycotting or harassing or vandalizing private businesses and communities in the United States of people who are of vague Eastern European descent, because, you know, people don't often know the difference, is not going to help and is just going to harm more innocent.
The actress Mila Kunis is Ukrainian.
Yeah.
And her husband, Ashton Kutcher, have started doing charity. What's the word I'm looking for?
Fundraisers.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Charity. Old guy stuff.
That's okay.
Charity fundraisers to raise money for Ukraine. And she used to spend her entire life. She came here like when she was nine. And she used to spend her time telling people that she was Russian, because when she tried to tell them she was Ukrainian, that ended up being, oh, where is that? Is that like near France, or where is the Ukraine?
Yeah.
So it's like she didn't bother telling people she was Ukrainian until just recently, because now everybody knows where Ukraine is, because wars do that for you.
Yes.
So it's like, should we take it out on Mila Kunis because we used to think she was Russian, but now we know she's Ukrainian? I mean, my ancestors, now, of course, I'm Jewish, I'm Ashkenazi. So Jews don't really consider themselves technically to be Russian or Ukrainian, because the Russians and Ukrainians certainly didn't. But the fact is, my ancestors came over at the turn of the 20th century from mostly like Galicia and areas around Kiev, mostly. But, you know, that was like 120 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, should I be lumped in with Russians or Ukrainians? No. Because it was part of Russia then.
Yeah. It's this kind of the inherent flaws in acting based on taking a modern situation, adding, you know, long historical, you know, context that's half remembered and was, you know, not necessarily verified in the first place, and trying to bundle it, some adding a dash of rage and trying to act on it. Like,
I'm assuming these are people that constantly confuse television and movie characters with the actors who play them.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Okay. Let's see. We didn't make a note of it, but I'm actually, I recognize the writer. And so this is from communityimpact.com, because we are micro news. The 2021 Houston job growth in Houston sets record. The Russian invasion raises economic concerns. 2021 was the best year on record for Houston's growth since 1981, according to Patrick Jankowski, the Greater Houston Partnership's senior vice president of research. Restaurants and bars saw the strongest job recovery in 2021. Jankowski raised concerns about potential data reporting issues for government employees, specifically teachers. He said, I think data is probably going to be revised in the next week or so, but I bet government jobs are being created. Out of the 20 largest metropolitan areas, Houston ranks 10th in terms of jobs recouped, with 80% of the area's employment returning to pre-pandemic levels, according to the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics. Jankowski said Houston's performance should not be attributed to the area's energy sector, which recovered to pre-pandemic levels. Rather, it should be attributed to construction and manufacturing jobs, which are still short of pre-pandemic levels. Jankowski discussed Russia's invasion into Ukraine in terms of potentially impacting economic growth in the Houston area. One potential supply chain issue was grain production. Russia and Ukraine combined produce about 25% of the world's grain production. Other impacted products include palladium, fertilizers, and corn. Jankowski said the lack of spring planting would affect crop yields and export markets. He said he does not see a recession in the cards for the Houston area, but did see the potential for growth to slow. I think all of this assumes that one way or another, this war won't go on too much longer. If it does, I think we will see significant repercussions here as well. But as they say, at least we're not sitting on a concrete floor in another country holding our cat, having left everything else behind. Andrew?
Well, this does sort of strike me. These predictions do sort of strike me as reasonable. I don't necessarily know. I mean, you know, we live in hope. We always live in hope that it's going to not be as bad as the projections. And a lot of the projections do turn out to be excessively negative. But it's not like we're in a good place. the phrase I think is war is good for business, but it's only good for certain types of business.
There's going to be a lot of, as they say, backfilling of weapons and
yeah, absolutely.
But you know, to be fair, this is essentially one man or group of men who have brought this upon the world, and we're sort of in a perfect storm coming. Mm-hmm. Sort of kind of out of a pandemic that we're still experiencing, which has caused significant economic dislocations. And then all of a sudden having possibly the start of a world war. I was reading an article, I think it was from CNN perhaps, that, you know, we generally pick a date for when World War II started. Being Eurocentric, we pick September 1st, 1939, which is when Germany invaded Poland and everybody declared war on each other. Yeah. But, you know, if you live in Asia, World War II started in 1931 when the Japanese invaded Manchuria.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it might be 1938 when the Germans annexed Austria and the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia.
Yeah.
So, you know, what was pointed out in the article is World War II didn't have a start date. It was a process.
Yeah.
And it started sort of rolling over years until the next thing you know, everybody's declaring war on everybody else. And with the colonies involved, it was a global conflict.
Yeah.
We could end up in a similar situation here. It could start in Ukraine. We could end up with NATO getting increasingly involved in more and more significant weapons transfers. They're talking now about anti-aircraft drones that we might start sending Ukraine. It, you know, Putin has already said that he will consider the transfer of weapons essentially an act of war. The Chinese now are talking about assisting in resupply of the Russians. And here's the thing. You might not want to start a war if you need to consider having China resupply your weapons. So serious strategic mistake in that case.
Yeah.
And, you know, tactical nukes, you can take out a part of a city without using a strategic weapon like we think of in terms of hundreds of kilotons or megatons. We don't know what the threshold is. You know, what happens if Putin decides to use, look, the argument framed in the article was, what if either the war goes to a stalemate for Russia, or amazingly, Russia starts to lose ground to the Ukrainians? Could Putin even envision the embarrassment, which of course is his concern, the embarrassment of losing a war to Ukraine? Would he then consider that the threshold for using an artillery nuke, which could be like a kiloton, wouldn't even take out a whole city? But is that the threshold for nuclear war or global war? Or would that be a forced peace because everyone suddenly is terrified? Oh, my God, the Russians threw a nuke.
Yeah.
Don't know.
Yeah. There's okay. Just a lot we don't know.
And we'll, one way or another, we will find out, because time is an arrow pointing in one direction. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m., live online at kpft.org, podcasting, or go to archive.kpft.org for previous shows. KPFT is Houston's community station with over 100 show titles. Doing that means we need community support to keep giving you that unique and varied programming. You can go to kpft.org and hit the donate button. All donations are tax deductible. Pick your favorite show, hopefully ours, and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between. And you may qualify for a lovely thank you gift, or pass on the thank you gift, let all the money ride, and frankly, you get a slightly bigger tax deduction. Spreading the word also helps. Word of mouth is free. Okay, our next story, at least 35 Texas hospitals were out of ICU beds last week, according to the latest federal data. Look up the ones near you if you click on the article. Each week, hospitals in Texas report their current ICU bed capacity to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The COVID-19 virus continues to send unvaccinated Texans to the hospital with serious illness every day, putting those facilities under enormous pressure to find room for new patients. Hospital staff has never been in shorter supply, which deepens the strain on all departments, including emergency rooms, respiratory therapy, and even labor and delivery. Without the capacity to take on new patients and with equally thin resources elsewhere to transfer them to, doctors fear they'll have to start making heartbreaking decisions about care in order to save the most lives possible. According to the federal government, the weekly ICU capacity number should not discourage patients from seeking medical care in these facilities. The agency said hospitals have protocols in place to keep patients safe from exposure and ensure all patients are prioritized for care. The vast majority of COVID-19 patients in hospitals and ICUs are unvaccinated. Doctors say mask wearing, hand washing, and social distancing are the best ways to slow down hospital numbers in the short term. And monoclonal antibody therapies for people with COVID-19 symptoms can keep them out of the hospital in many cases. They also say the only way to permanently slow down the spike in hospitalizations is to vaccinate the majority of the state. Now, that little bit from the Tribune left me wondering what exactly they were implying, so I did a little research. I went to usafacts.org. How many COVID-19 vaccines has Texas administered is the question. In Texas, at least 72% of the state, and this is as of March 14th, in Texas, at least 72% of the state has received at least one dose. 60% of the Texas population is considered fully vaccinated, which means either one of the Johnson & Johnson or two of the others. 22% of Texas's population have received a booster dose. So I interpret that as meaning essentially 22% of Texas's population is fully vaccinated, 60% is originally vaccinated, and, you know, another 12% is, at least I got something. So there are charts in this article, which obviously I can't translate on the radio. Regardless, one of the most concerning things is that this week's number of Texas ICU beds in use is at levels equivalent to the latter half of 2020, which is to say before a vaccine, according to those graphics. For those folks, including, I have to say, leaders in the Democratic Party, people that we often consider to be liberals or even very liberal, we have folks that are starting to say that COVID should be now treated as endemic, get back to life as usual, we have the vaccine. I say, tell it to the medical professionals. We need full vaccination rates in the 90% range in areas where we think life can get back to normal. If those areas, if there are areas that are not in the 90% range, you still need to be especially careful with your hand washing, your mask wearing, and your getting vaccinated. Yeah. I think the term that I used when we were discussing this earlier is Texas has a lot of people that are sort of vaccinated-ish.
Yes. Yeah. And it's absolutely baffling to see how many people who were, if not willing to do whatever was necessary to contain the virus in the early days of the pandemic, were at least understanding of some of the more inconvenient measures, are now just saying, you know, they're standing side by side with the same people who have always said, oh, it's a hoax, it's not really happening, all those people aren't really dead, or they're dying of something else, and they're being,
crisis actors.
Yeah, they're crisis actors or whatever. And they're
very
saying,
convincing, you know.
It's only the
first 5 minutes of holding your breath that's hard.
they're saying it's over. Let's just, you know, get back to work and get the economy moving again, because money is all that matters. And it doesn't matter how many people are dying. And it's ridiculous to me. I understand why they're taking these positions. It's because if they don't, they won't have the capital that they need to get reelected, a lot of them. But, you know, there are times when your reelection does not matter as much as having voters to reelect you in the first place. So
well, I think there's a certain amount of, you know, people that originally were saying we have to take measures, we have to socially distance, we have to wear masks. I think ultimately you get to a point where you throw up your hands and say, what am I supposed to do? I can't put a gun to these people's heads. I can't make them do stuff. And it's like I can lead from the front or I can lead from behind. And unfortunately, many of these people are just giving up and having to lead from behind. You know, it's been over 2 years. It's becoming just very, very hard. And unfortunately, that probably means we'll have COVID with us for a while. It's worth noting, though, I did read something about the 1918 flu, which was actually the 1918, 1919, 1920, partially 1921 flu, that it did at some point peter out. What we don't know, and that's even given the fact that the flu does mutate rapidly. So, you know, it's possible that this may sort of peter out. But at this point, we don't know. And World War I, by the way, did nothing for inhibiting the flu.
Right.
And here we are starting in the middle of a war. It ain't pretty.
No.
Okay. Next story is from the Texas Tribune. Governor Greg Abbott replaces the Texas military leader who has overseen the heavily criticized border mission. Major General Thomas M. Swelzer will take over as the military department's new leader. He replaces Major General Tracy Norris, who was criticized for her handling of Operation Lone Star as Adjutant General of the Texas Military Department. I didn't even know there was such a thing. I just thought of it as the National Guard. Norris began her three-year tenure at the helm of the department in 2019, but came under heavy criticism in recent months after a massive ramp-up of Operation Lone Star. I mean, really, was that the only name they could come up with? Anyway, Operation Lone Star last fall led to pay issues, poor living conditions, and a lack of appropriate gear for troops on the mission. Abbott did not acknowledge criticism of Norris in his statement, instead thanking her for her work with the department. Her predecessor as Adjutant General of the department served for nearly 7 years. Better O'Rourke, the Democrat challenging Abbott in the November election, put the blame for the mission's recent controversies squarely at the incumbent governor's feet. Beto said, "You can switch generals, but we all know where the buck stops." Greg Abbott took 10,000 Guard members from their families, jobs, and communities, O'Rourke said in a statement. He has treated them with incredible disrespect, and he has delayed their pay, cut their tuition benefits in half, and used them as political pawns in his reelection campaign. It's time to bring them home, Beto concluded. Specialist Hunter Schuler, a soldier on the border mission who represents fellow troops as a coordinator for the, and I didn't know this either, the Texas State Employees Union's Military Council, welcomed the change in leadership as well. Specialist Schuler said, when faced with logistical failures, suicides, and abhorrent conditions, Major General Norris and her executive staff were slow to make corrections, deflected from their mistakes, repeatedly misled service members, and lied to the public. We are optimistic about M.G. Swelzer and hope that he will make other overdue leadership changes and advocate for his service members' best interests, including releasing them from this involuntary political stunt on the border. Powerful statement. A unionization effort was largely spurred by what service members saw as failures by leadership during Operation Lone Star. So my observation here, for Governor Abbott, apparently the buck stops somewhere down the line. This was an ill-conceived and pointless mission that was severely and pointlessly severely and pointlessly disrupted the lives of service members, and in which they actually have no meaningful impact on illegal border crossing. They don't literally have any power. No wonder it provoked a unionization effort. It's just been a really sad political stunt. Andrew?
Well, this may come across as a little harsh to some people, but my concern is not with the well-being of the military that's been deployed in this. My concern is, what kind of impact has this had on the people who are trying to legally cross the border into Texas, or honestly, even the people who are illegally trying to cross the border into Texas, because they're still people and they still deserve not to be, you know, terrorized by the sight of, you know, National Guard members who are armed and, you know, keeping watch over the border.
Actually, I don't think they're armed, which is one of the reasons it's pointless to have them there. They literally don't have any power to stop anyone, because you're not allowed to use military forces in the United States unless there's some kind of a state of emergency declared.
Well, and okay, all right, fair enough. But that's even more reason to just stop this operation. It is a waste of resources. It is something that is, I'm sure, just seeing military members on the border, even if you are just perfectly, your papers are all in order and you're not doing anything wrong, is going to cause distress to people who are trying to enter the United States. You know, there's just no good reason for it.
And if you're a conservative, think of the wasted money.
Yeah, true. I don't necessarily know that replacing the person in charge of the department is going to help at all, because, you know, you can't make a bad idea into a good idea just by a change of leadership.
But Abbott's buck starts somewhere else, or stops somewhere else, rather.
Yeah. So
it sounded so witty before I screwed it up. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can hear the show live online at kpft.org. I recommend podcasting it, or you can go to archive.kpft.org to listen to prior shows and other titles. Every story on the show is heavily excerpted, so we include links to full articles at thinkwingradio.com. We are also on social media, where we take questions, comments, and suggestions. Check the show's Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. Again, look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. And Andrew, you have a couple of accounts I think you'd like to mention.
I sure do. You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE, on Tumblr spelled the same at DominateI.tumblr.com, and if you're interested in hearing me talk more about my politics and about the news of the day, as well as an interest in video games, you can watch me live stream on Twitch at twitch.tv/DominateEYE. I go live 8 p.m. U.S. Central Time on Mondays and Fridays currently.
Our next story is from Politico.com. Raskin withdraws as Biden's Fed nominee. Sarah Bloom Raskin has been stuck in the Senate Banking Committee amid a GOP boycott, because that's what they do, of a committee vote on her nomination, effectively blocking her confirmation from advancing to the Senate floor. Raskin, a former Fed governor and deputy treasury secretary during the Obama years, had been confirmed twice before those posts with no opposition from Republicans, but she faced blowback this time from GOP lawmakers and Joe Manchin over her calls for regulators to more closely scrutinize bank lending to oil and gas companies and help mitigate climate-related risks to the financial system. She wrote, "Their point of contention was my frank public discussion of climate change and the economic costs associated with it," in a letter to Biden, according to the New Yorker. "It was and is my considered view," she said, "that the perils of climate change must be added to the list of serious risks that the Federal Reserve considers as it works to ensure the stability and resiliency of our economy and financial system." While the financial industry raised no public objections to Raskin's nomination, Republicans expressed fear that she might pursue measures that would make it more expensive for banks to lend to oil companies. Now, here's the thing. Republicans, pro-oil, pro-gas, in many cases pro-coal, energy independence for the United States. And I just can't figure out, what is it about renewable energy that doesn't count toward energy independence for the United States? Mm. We're going to achieve energy independence one way or another. We are either going to achieve it on our terms, or we're going to achieve it because for some reason we can no longer buy it. That's just the way it is. We should want to do it on our terms, whether that energy comes from coal or oil or gas or wind or solar, or rechargeable batteries. Why energy independence is not considered to be the entire mix of energy resources and only petrochemicals, I don't understand it. It doesn't make any sense to me. These people are just, I don't know, tunnel vision. I don't understand it. Andrew?
Well, I can't say that I know what's going on in their heads, but I can speculate that it may have to do with what particular sectors are considered their friends and which ones
that may have. But that doesn't make sense either, because these sectors have money that they can make money off of in renewable energy. I mean, they don't have their feet in cement overshoes, right, financially speaking. They can take money that isn't going toward oil and put it into renewables. It's not a zero-sum game here. So I don't get it. You can invest your money and make money in some other way than oil and gas.
And some of these companies do that, but they don't spend nearly as much on their renewable sectors as they do their more traditional oil and gas sectors. And, you know, to bring a little bit of, you know, anti-capitalist analysis in here, there is a phenomenon in capitalism where stuff that would be more efficient or effective, even generate larger amounts of profit, then would also happen to reduce human suffering, are not put in place. And measures that would do those things are not put in place because it is easier to simply keep doing what the way things are, because that is a state of affairs that the people in power are familiar with, that they know and that they have influence in. And it is safer for them to keep going business as usual than to do anything that would even benefit them, just because it would be different. They'd have to figure out a different landscape.
But you know what? This is partly a messaging issue. because energy independence has become shorthand for oil and gas. And we need a messaging change that energy independence means energy, whether it's oil or gas or renewables. It's energy. And if we are going to be building electric cars, even a small percentage of electric cars, you know what? We might as well make electricity with renewables and charge those cars. I mean, we need to change the messaging. I hate to repeat myself, so that's all I'm going to say.
I think it might help, but I think that, unfortunately, we're not going to be able to make the kind of changes with policy that you would like to see until we have either different people in charge of the major companies, the major energy companies, or we have some kind of people in government who are willing to put these energy companies over a barrel and say, you will change what you do or else you will no longer exist. You know, whether that's through being broken up or being nationalized, whatever. So,
well, I want to get to the next story. Mm-hmm. I'm going to warn you, this is a long story. I'm going to try to read it in an inflected way that doesn't make your ears glaze over. But believe it or not, it's only half as long as the actual story. So it's really important. Bear with me. The story from the New York Times is First Amendment scholars want to see the media lose these cases. Some legal experts say it's time to draw a sharp line between protected speech and harmful disinformation. The lawyers and First Amendment scholars who have made it their life's work to defend the well-established but newly threatened constitutional protections for journalists don't usually root for the media to lose in court. But that's what's happening with a series of recent defamation lawsuits against right-wing outlets that legal experts say could be the most significant libel litigation in recent memory. The suits, which are being argued in several state and federal courts, accuse Project Veritas, Fox News, The Gateway Pundit, One America News, and others of intentionally promoting and profiting from false claims of voter fraud during the 2020 election and of smearing innocent civil servants and businesses in the process. If the outlets prevail, these experts say, the results will call into question more than a half century of precedent that created a clear legal framework for establishing when news organizations can be held liable for publishing something that's not true. Libel cases are difficult to prove in the United States. Among other things, public figures have to show that someone has published what the Supreme Court has called a calculated falsehood or acted with reckless disregard for the truth. But numerous First Amendment lawyers said they thought the odds were strong that at least one of these outlets would suffer a rare loss at trial, given the extensive and well-documented evidence against them. The high legal bar to prove defamation had become an increasingly sore subject well before the 2020 election, mainly but not exclusively among conservatives, prompting calls to reconsider the broad legal immunity that has shielded journalists since the landmark 1964 Supreme Court decision New York Times versus Sullivan. Critics include politicians like former President Donald J. Trump and Sarah Palin, who lost the defamation suit against the Times last month and has asked for a new trial, as well as two Supreme Court justices, Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch. Lee Levine, a veteran First Amendment lawyer who has defended some of the biggest media outlets in the country in libel cases, said a finding of liability in the cases making their way through the courts could demonstrate that the bar set by Sullivan did what it was supposed to do, make it possible to punish the intentional or extremely reckless dissemination of false information while protecting the press from lawsuits over inadvertent errors. The Sullivan case, which legal scholars consider as seminal to the First Amendment as Brown versus Board of Education Topeka was to civil rights, established the actual malice standard for defamation. It requires that a suing public figure prove a person or media outlet knew what it said was false or acted with reckless disregard for the high probability that it was wrong. Calls to weaken that precedent drew considerable resistance from advocates for press freedom, but many of them have come to see the threat of a defamation suit, a tactic often used by the powerful to retaliate against and mute unwelcome criticism, as an essential tool in the battle against disinformation. Increasingly, many First Amendment lawyers see the courts as one of the last viable paths to deter the spread of political disinformation and help prevent repeats of dangerous situations, from another January 6th-style riot to the more isolated threats against local officials that grew out of Trump's false insistence that the election was stolen from him. I think we are at a time in U.S. history and world history of losing any ability as a civilization to distinguish between truth and falsity, said Rodney Smala, a lawyer representing Dominion Voting Systems, a technology company suing Fox News and several individuals who promoted conspiracy theories about the last election, including Rudolph Giuliani and Sidney Powell. A judge in Delaware, where the Dominion suit was filed, denied Fox's motion to dismiss the case in December, and it is now in the discovery phase. As a defense, Fox and others invoked the First Amendment and Sullivan, arguing that their reporting on the 2020 election and its aftermath is legally indistinguishable from the kind of basic, just-the-facts journalism that news organizations have always produced. Fox has portrayed itself as a neutral observer, saying it did not endorse claims about hacked voting machines and systemic fraud, but instead offered a platform for others to make statements that were unquestionably newsworthy. As Fox News mounts its defense in the Dominion case and in a lawsuit by another voting system company, Smartmatic, the network's lawyers have argued that core to the First Amendment is the ability to report on all newsworthy statements, even false ones, without having to assume responsibility for them. Its lawyers wrote, "The public had a right to know and Fox had a right to cover." As for inviting guests who made fallacious claims and spun wild stories, the network, quoting the Sullivan decision, argued that, quote, "giving them a forum to make even groundless claims is part and parcel of the uninhibited, robust, and wide-open debate on matters of public concern." Last week, a federal judge ruled this Smartmatic case against Fox could go forward, writing that at this point, quote, "plaintiffs have pleaded facts sufficient to allow a jury to infer that Fox News acted with actual malice." Many aren't on Fox's side this time. If the network prevails, some said the argument that the actual malice standard is too onerous and needs to be reconsidered could be bolstered. So someone once made the comment that the First Amendment is not a suicide pact, and it's the equivalent of yelling fire in a crowded theater to willfully, knowingly publish inflammatory, if you will, lies.
I can see to some extent Fox's argument that sometimes things that are going to be newsworthy are not going to be true. But I think with the ability to report on what's newsworthy comes the responsibility of making sure you're not distorting the truth. If you're going to report on a lie, you need to be open about the fact that it's a lie and what makes it a lie. And Fox, I think, has been forgetting the second half of that equation.
We distort, you decide. Okay, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT HD2. My co-host and indispensable editor and patient guy is Andrew Ferguson. We'll look forward to seeing you next week. You all take care.
See you later.
I'll come back now to Honest Clyde's. We'll give you a good deal.
Yeah, I got your good deal, Honest Clyde.
Now, honey, be nice.
The guy was lowballing us. This car's worth three times as much as he was offering. Let's get out of here. Turn on the radio.
That was another great song on KPFT. Do you have a car that you don't use and you need it gone? Donate it to KPFT. It's tax deductible, and we can arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from the sale are invested in KPFT, helping keep community radio on the air. Call 1-855-KPFT-CAR.
What a great idea! We can get a tax deduction and support KPFT.
It is a great idea. Call 1-855-KPFT-CAR. Okay, that's 1-855-573-KPFT. 8227.
It's Friday night. The inmates go quiet. Listen, poor old boys, they know.
It's time to holler down the pipe chase and rattle them bars.
The Prison Show airs Fridays 9 to 11 p.m. at 90.1 FM KPFT. For over 40 years, each two-hour program uses an hour to discuss issues and organizations of importance to prisoners and their families to help educate and inform our listeners. The second hour broadcasts shout-outs, live calls from inmates' family and friends so inmates can hear their loved ones speaking on the air. For over 40 years, the show has connected Texas prison inmates with their friends and loved ones over the airwaves. You can't find an older Texas show, and it's right here on KPFT every Friday, 9 to 11 p.m. at 90.1 FM, KPFT, or online at kpft.org, Houston's Community Station.